Imagine you just bought a new home.
Oh, that's always a huge milestone.
Right, it is. But then, let's say a week later, a registered sex offender moves in right down the street.
Wow. Yeah, that is, I mean, obviously that's a deeply unsettling scenario for any community.
Absolutely. But stepping back and looking at it as an empirical economist, this situation actually presents a really complex measurement problem.
Oh, without a doubt. It's incredibly tricky.
Because, how do you rigorously quantify the financial damage to local property values
Right.
from something like that?
Right.
And furthermore, does that negative impact just stop at the end of the block? Or does it bleed into the next zip code?
Yeah, and that's exactly where the standard toolkit we use for policy evaluation often kind of falls short.
Also.
Well, think about when we measure the impact of a new state tax law. The boundary there is administrative, and it's perfectly sharp.
Right. You either live in the state and pay the tax, or you live like 1 foot over the border and you don't.
Exactly. But in the world of urban economics, that neat administrative line just vanishes. Treatment is defined strictly by a coordinate on a map.
Which is much messier. So, welcome to our deep dive. Today, we are tailoring this session specifically for you, the graduate student in economics.
Yes, consider this your formal methodological study guide.
We are unpacking spatial difference in differences. And we're going to focus intensely on how to estimate causal effects using geocoded microdata.
And we're going to anchor this discussion using the classic 2008 paper by Linden and Rockoff.
Right, their paper on sex offender locations. We'll be looking strictly at the statistical mechanics of how they and how modern econometricians measure these highly localized price impacts.
Right, so Linden and Rockoff concluded that home prices dropped by approximately 7.5% within a 0.1-mile radius of an offender's location.
7.5%. But wait, as an autonometrician, that specific distance, 0.1 miles, that should immediately trigger a warning light, right?
Exactly. We have to ask how much that 7.5% conclusion relies entirely on the singular choice of that 0.1-mile radius.
Because we're dealing with distance as a continuous running variable.
Precisely, which means the researchers' assumptions about where the treated zone actually ends take center stage.
Makes sense. So our roadmap for this study guide is straightforward. We'll formally define the Ring DID approach and talk through the logic of implementing its parametric estimator.
And then we're going to expose the profound fragility of that estimator. We'll use a simulated data set for that, where we actually control the mathematical truth.
Right. And once we understand the flaw, we'll introduce the modern non-parametric data-driven alternative.
And finally, we will apply both methods back onto the real Linden Rockoff data to reconcile the
We're
results.
perfect. So let's jump in. We should begin with the core intuition and formally define the Ring DID.
Yeah, let's do it. Because treatment is defined by proximity to a spatial point, we segment our observations into geometric zones.
Okay, zones.
Right. So the treated group consists of the units sitting inside a narrowly defined radius around the point. We call this the inner ring.
And the control group.
The control group consists of the units sitting in a donut-shaped area immediately outside that radius, which we call the outer ring.
Got it. I think it helps to visualize this using a street lamp analogy.
Oh, I like that one.
Yeah, so imagine measuring how much a newly installed street lamp illuminates a dark sidewalk. You wouldn't compare the concrete directly under the new lamp to like a sidewalk in a completely different city.
Right, that wouldn't make any sense.
No, you would compare the patch of concrete sitting directly under the lamp, so that's your inner ring, to a patch of concrete maybe 50 feet away.
Which is your outer ring.
Exactly. Both before and after the lamp is turned on.
That captures the spatial logic perfectly. However, for that comparison to hold any causal weight, we must satisfy a core identifying assumption.
A local parallel trends assumption, right?
Yes. In spatial econometrics, we refer to this as local parallel trends. Kyle Butz formalized this recently as Assumption 2 in his 2023 work.
Okay, and what does assumption two dictate exactly?
It dictates that in the absence of the treatment, the average change in the outcome variable must evolve identically in both the inner ring and the outer ring.
Okay, so returning to the street lamp, the local parallel trends assumption means that if the new lamp had never been installed, the natural moonlight hitting both the inner patch and the outer patch of concrete would have changed in the exact same way over time.
Exactly. And translating that to a housing market, this assumes no other highly localized shock uniquely affected the inner ring while sparing the outer ring during that exact same time period.
Right. That is the critical hurdle. So, like, if the inner ring of a neighborhood was already experiencing a faster rate of gentrification than the outer ring before the individual moved in,
then our assumption is violated, and our spatial estimator is fundamentally biased.
Got it. So, assuming parallel trends holds, let's break down the implementation of the parametric ring estimator.
Good idea.
For the graduate student coding this up right now, it's helpful to realize that the ring, DID, is mechanically just the textbook 2x2 difference in differences mapped onto geographic distance.
Yes, it calculates the average treatment effect on the treated the ATT by subtracting the average change in the outer ring from the average change in the inner ring.
Right. So practically, you're taking your continuous spatial data and collapsing it into a binary format.
Exactly. A unit is either strictly inside the cutoff radius or it's outside of it.
So in a statistical software environment like R, using a fast fixed effects package like Fixist, you're basically running a one-line regression.
Just a single line, yeah.
You'd run the fields function.
Yeah.
You regress the change in the outcome variable, like the change in log home prices,
yeah,
against a simple dummy variable that flags whether the home sits inside your chosen radius.
And you'll also include fixed effects to control for broader time trends and neighborhood characteristics.
Right, right.
It's really important to highlight the algebraic equivalence here for everyone's notes. Running that regression on a first difference outcome variable is mathematically identical to running a two-way fixed effects regression on panel data.
PWFE.
Right. If you use a PWFE model, you include unit fixed effects, time fixed effects, and an interaction term between the treatment group and the post-treatment time period.
So whether you first difference the panel natively or let the TWFE model handle the demeaning, you get the same thing.
Exactly. The interaction coefficient will yield the exact same point estimate and standard error.
Okay, but the theoretical catch with this parametric estimator lies in how we interpret its output, right? Because it just returns a single scalar parameter.
Yes, just one number.
Think about trying to measure the temperature of a massive lecture hall by taking the average temperature of the front half and comparing it to the average of the back half.
I get a very clean summary number.
Right. But you've manually predetermined where the front of the room ends.
And this rigid predetermination is the core vulnerability of the parametric method.
It's a huge assumption.
It is. To thoroughly diagnose this fragility, we really need to step away from the empirical data for a minute and build a simulated sandbox.
Because in a simulation, the exact treatment effect is mathematically known.
Precisely. We control the ground truth.
Okay, let's construct that simulation. Picture a spatial data set containing 10,000 units.
Okay, 10,000 units.
And we program the true treatment effect to follow this steep exponential decay curve. Right at the epicenter, the effect is severe, peaking at a value of 1.5.
So massive impact right at the center.
Exactly. But as you move outward, the impact decays smoothly and gets exactly zero at a distance of 0.75 miles.
And beyond that 0.75 miles, there's absolutely no effect.
Right, mathematically zero. So if you integrate the area under that specific curve within the 0.75 mile radius, the true average treatment effect is exactly 0.726.
Okay, so we've established our ground truth. The true cutoff is 0.75 miles, and the true average effect is 0.726.
Right.
If a researcher applies the parametric estimator to this data and magically guesses the exact 0.75 mile cutoff, the regression perfectly recovers the value of 0.726.
Oh, okay. So under perfect foresight, the estimator is completely unbiased.
Yes, but researchers rarely possess perfect foresight.
That's putting it mildly.
Okay.
So if I'm analyzing this data blindly and I decide to draw my inner ring extremely narrow, say at 0.30 miles, what happens?
Your estimator returns a value of 0.913.
0.913, that's a massive upward bias.
It is, because you're only sampling the steepest, most intense section of the exponential curve near the epicenter.
Oh, I see. My model is basically entirely ignoring the long, subtle tail of the decay.
Exactly. Conversely, if you cast your net too wide and define the inner ring at 1.20 miles, the estimator returns 0.456, down to 0.456. So that is a textbook demonstration of attenuation bias.
You got it. Your designated treated ring now includes hundreds of units located past the 0.75 mile mark.
Units that experience zero impact.
Right. But because they are trapped inside your arbitrarily wide boundary, their zeros actively dilute the average of the genuinely affected units.
This highlights a profound methodological problem. The choice of the spatial ring isn't just a matter of tuning for statistical precision or, you know, minimizing standard errors.
No, not at all.
The boundary fundamentally changes the estimate itself. It's the equivalent of asking what percentage of a city supports a new infrastructure bill.
And the answer will swing wildly depending on where you draw the city limits.
Right. The boundary is an active variable in the question being asked.
And if the researcher's discretionary boundary choice completely dictates the statistical outcome, the credibility of the entire analysis is at risk. Because a motivated researcher could simply adjust the radius until they find a statistically significant effect that matches their preferred narrative.
Exactly. This fragility is precisely why modern econometricians rely on non-parametric solutions.
To pull the researcher's judgment out of the equation.
Yes, and let the spatial data speak for itself.
And that brings us to the non-parametric alternative, specifically the Binsrag approach.
Right, developed by Cattaneo, Crump, Farrell, and Fang in 2024.
And applied to spatial econometrics by Kyle Butts. So instead of forcing the researcher to guess a single cutoff point, this method maps the continuous gradient of the effect.
The mechanics of the algorithm are really elegant.
How does it actually work under the hood?
It takes the entire support of your distance variable from the epicenter all the way out to your most distant control unit and partitions it into data-driven bins.
Okay, bins?
Crucially, these bins are quantile spaced, ensuring that each bin contains an adequate number of observations to maintain statistical power.
Oh, that's smart. So once it's partitioned, the algorithm basically fits a flat constant inside each of those bins.
Exactly. It then calculates the difference between each bin and the furthest bin, which acts as the baseline untreated control.
So returning to our temperature analogy, instead of asking, is it warmer near the window, yes or no?
Yeah.
You are walking a thermometer from the window to the far wall in equal steps.
Right. You record the precise temperature at each stop,
allowing you to plot a continuous granular curve of how the heat dissipates across the room.
Perfect analogy. When we unleash the Binsrag algorithm on our simulated dataset, the algorithm independently creates 53 distinct spatial bins.
Without any human intervention.
Without any human intervention or pre-committed cutoffs. It flawlessly recovers the exact exponential decay curve we programmed.
Wow.
Yeah, crossing the zero effect line perfectly at 0.75 miles.
Okay, so that proves the superiority of the non-parametric method in a controlled environment. Now, let's take these tools back to the real-world Linden-Rockoff data and see how they perform. We're looking at 9,092 home transactions that occurred within a third of a mile of an offender's address.
We begin with the classical parametric estimator. The original authors visually estimated an impact radius of 0.1 miles.
Right. And if we use that canonical 0.1 mile inner ring, our fixed effects regression yields a log point coefficient of -0.0595.
Translated into percentage terms, that represents a 5.78% drop in home prices.
With a really tight standard error of 0.0225.
Exactly.
A 5.78% drop seems definitive until we test for the wobble we observed in the simulation.
Ah, the wobble.
Yeah, if a researcher analyzing this exact same data decides to use a slightly tighter cutoff of 0.05 miles, the calculated price drop jumps to 6.40%.
And if another researcher prefers a slightly wider cutoff of 0.15 miles, the estimated drop shrinks to 4.21%.
That is a 52% relative spread between the two estimates, driven exclusively by the researcher's choice of where to draw the line.
That level of variance is deeply unsettling when policymakers rely on these figures.
Absolutely. So let's observe what happens when we deploy the non-parametric Binsrag algorithm on the exact same 9,092 transactions.
The algorithm partitions the data into 23 quantile-spaced bins.
And the results in those inner bins are staggering compared to the parametric average.
They really are. Bin 1 captures the homes located within the first 300 feet of the offender's location.
And the localized price drop in bin 1 is a massive 20.6%.
Yeah. Bin 2, slightly further out, shows a 15.2% drop.
The critical threshold emerges at bin 3, which sits approximately 0.08 miles away.
Right. At this distance, the price drop shrinks to 2.9% and actually loses statistical significance.
And by the time we reach bin 4, at exactly 0.10 miles, the estimated effect is positive 0.6%, which is effectively zero.
So a graduate student looking at these two outputs is faced with a stark contradiction.
Right. The parametric model claims the effect is a 5.78% drop, while the non-parametric model shows the primary effect is a 20.6% drop.
Running on the exact same data.
We have to reconcile how both methodologies are technically functioning as designed.
Well, they are answering fundamentally different questions.
Okay, break that down for me.
The parametric method is indiscriminately averaging the entire 0.1-mile zone. It mathematically blends that catastrophic 20.6% drop right at the epicenter with the near-zero effect lingering at the outer edge of the ring.
So it provides a mathematically correct average, but it severely dilutes the extreme localized intensity.
Exactly. The non-parametric method unmasks the true shape of that intensity.
There is an incredibly elegant validation embedded in this contradiction, though.
You noticed that, too.
Yeah, if you look closely at the non-parametric curve, the effect fully dissipates and crosses the zero line at roughly 0.094 miles.
Which is practically 0.1 miles.
Exactly. This mathematically vindicates Linden and Rockoff's original 2008 paper. Back then, they didn't have these algorithmic tools. They chose the 0.1-mile cutoff visually by eyeballing the smooth price gradients.
The modern data-driven approach didn't invalidate their classical setup. It disciplined it. And it proved their spatial intuition was remarkably accurate.
It's a phenomenal example of methodological progression validating early empirical instincts.
It really is. However, for the practitioner relying on this study guide, we must discuss aggregation.
Oh, right. Because if you generate a beautiful 23-bin step function, but your publisher demands a single summary number for the abstract, aggregating those bins requires a lot of caution.
Yes. You cannot simply take an unweighted average across the individual bins.
Because a simple bin equal average of the affected area in this data set yields an 11.4% drop.
Right. But if you calculate a sample weighted average, factoring in the actual density of homes within each bin, the drop becomes 12.4%.
It shifts the third significant digit. It's akin to averaging the temperature of three distinct rooms in a building.
Yeah. If you want to know the average temperature experienced by a person, your calculation must weight the rooms by their headcount.
Right. You can't merely treat an empty supply closet the same as a packed auditorium.
Precisely. The econometric goal is to find the average effect on the average treated unit, not the average effect on the average spatial bin.
That's a great way to put it.
Oh.
Now, beyond aggregation, we also have to document the untestable assumptions threatening our identification strategy.
The most prominent is the assumption of no anticipation.
Meaning we have to trust that the local housing market didn't price in the arrival of the individual before they actually moved in.
Right. If rumors circulated and prices dropped early, our post-treatment measurements are attenuated.
Because they're capturing only a fraction of the total economic damage.
Additionally, the non-parametric results provide us with an informal suggestive tool regarding our parallel trends assumption.
Oh, how so?
Remember that the bins stretching past 0.1 miles hover non-significantly around zero.
Right.
While it doesn't definitively prove parallel trends across time, it provides strong cross-sectional evidence that the broader neighborhood wasn't undergoing chaotic, localized price shocks.
Ah, I see. If those distant, untreated bins were fluctuating wildly instead of flatlining, it would cast severe doubt on the stability of our control group.
Exactly.
Okay, to summarize this methodological framework, The parametric estimator provides a mathematically valid but frequently attenuated summary average.
And it demands the researcher make a high-stakes assumption about the spatial boundary.
Right, whereas the non-parametric estimator maps a highly localized, data-driven view of the treatment curve's true shape.
Both tools belong in an empirical researcher's toolkit.
However, the cardinal rule of spatial econometrics is to always start by simulating your data-generating process.
Recognizing that your choice of a spatial boundary fundamentally defines your estimand.
I think we've covered a lot of ground today.
We have, but I'll leave you with a final theoretical concept to consider as you design your own research.
Okay, let's hear it.
We have spent this session meticulously measuring the mathematical shape of a non-parametric treatment curve. But consider how the geometry of that curve can actually diagnose the underlying economic mechanism at play.
Diagnosing the mechanism.
Right.
Just by analyzing how quickly the effect decays.
Exactly. Suppose you apply this spatial DID toolkit to evaluate the construction of a new transit station versus, say, the installation of a massive wind turbine.
Okay.
If your non-parametric curve for the transit station shows a steep immediate exponential decay within just a few hundred feet, while the wind turbine shows a slow linear fade stretching for 2 miles, those geometries tell a story.
Oh, wow. They imply a completely different mix of externalities.
Exactly. The steep drop-off of the transit station maps to the physics of noise pollution,
while the long linear fade of the turbine maps to the sprawling reach of visual aesthetic impacts.
Right. The methodology doesn't just measure the size of an economic impact.
It allows the mathematical geometry of space to reveal the underlying geometry of human preferences.
When executed with rigor, it elevates spatial analysis from a simple measurement task to a powerful diagnostic tool.
That is a powerful framework for any empirical design. Thank you for joining us for this intensive methodological deep dive. As you move forward in your research, carefully consider how you measure localized policy effects. Always ask yourself if you are relying on an invisible administrative boundary or if you have mathematically mapped the actual blast radius.